Unlike the ninth of Av, which of course commemorates the Chorban of both the Bayis Rishon
and the Bayis Sheni, and unlike the 17th of Tammuz, that also commemorates events that occurred both during the Bayis Rishon and the Bayis Sheni, Asara B'Teves is only connected to the Chorban Bayis Rishon. There is nothing that we know of that occurred on Asara B'Teves in connection with the Bayis Sheni. The Bayis Rishon, the Bayis that Shlomo HaMelech built, was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian kingdom. The standard historical year that is given, although it has much controversy about it, is 586 BCE. That's a very well-known date, but the reason why Chazal don't seem to work with that date is because we know that the Babylonian exile was 70 years, and we know that the second temple lasted for 420 years. That would mean between the Chorban Bayis Rishon and the Chorban Bayis Sheni would be 490 years. But we also know that the Bayis Sheni was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. Now between 586 BCE and the year 70 is well over 600 years, almost 700 years, when in fact Chazal have only 490 years. Because of that, it's a big, big controversy. Some would assume that according to Chazal, the Chorban Bayis Rishon must have been much, and there are many, many theories about this. I saw a whole book that tried to give all the different answers, like 150 different resolutions for this. We don't have to be machria. But what is Asara B'Teves? Asara B'Teves was when Nebuchadnezzar began the siege against Jerusalem. The Navi Yechezkel was already in Babylonia, because 11 years before Chorban, Eretz Yisrael was already conquered. It was already a vassal state. And the Talmidei Chachamim and many of the Gedolim were already exiled to Babylonia, including Yechezkel. This is called the Charesh and the Masker, and Chazal say it was Bashkacha Pretis, that there would be 11 years where Torah could be rebuilt in Bavel. But Yechezkel is the great Navi who is in Chutz La'aretz. Yirmiyahu, his contemporary, is the Navi who remains in Eretz Yisrael. In the Nasara B'Teves, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yechezkel in Babylonia, write down Bi'etzem Hayom Hazeh. Make a note that on this very day, the 10th of Teves, Nebuchadnezzar has began his siege against Yerushalayim. There was no email or phone calls then. This was a prophetic revelation. Yechezkel wrote it down, and when the news came many weeks later, Huksa here, the city has been smitten, and Asara B'Teves, Yechezkel pulled out his little note, and everyone knew that he was a Navi Lashem. Bi'etzem Hayom Hazeh. This was the beginning. This was the beginning. This was not yet the Chorban. That was years later. But it was the beginning of the siege. And because of this, because of the unusual phraseology, Bi'etzem Hayom Hazeh, that very day, which is the same words that the Torah uses for Yom Kippur, Bi'etzem Hayom Hazeh. One of the great commentaries, Rav David Avudraham, actually writes that if Asara B'Teves could fall out on Shabbos, which it cannot based on our calendar, we would even fast on Shabbos itself. Because Bi'etzem Hayom Hazeh. As it is, Asara B'Teves does fall out on Friday. Perhaps you remember this. And it is the only fast that we actually fast, because even Yom Kippur does not fall out on Friday. Asara B'Teves falls out on Friday. And when it falls out on Friday, we fast all the way until Shabbos, even though we're entering Shabbos in a state. And I remember it actually happens. The Avudram says, even if it would fall out on Shabbos, you would fast. Bi'etzem Hayom Hazeh, which we don't do for Tishbev. Tishbev itself, we don't fast on Shabbos. there's a word from the Chassam Sofer that's very telling. Why do you fast on Shabbos? Because of the Tzar of the Chorban? Well, Tisha B'Av is the real Chorban. We don't fast on Shabbos. The Chassam Sofer offers the following interesting explanation. Except for Yom Kippur, we of course do not fast on Shabbos. But there's one fast you're allowed to fast on Shabbos. And that is, if God forbid a person had a bad dream, a dream of something bad happening, the halacha is that you are allowed to fast on Shabbos. That's called the Tanit Chalom. Of course, the halacha is a little funny here. You're allowed to fast on Shabbos, but because you committed the sin of fasting on Shabbos, you must fast again during the week to get the atonement for fasting on Shabbos and the like. But you're allowed to fast on Shabbos. The Chassam Sofer says, why are you allowed to have a Tanit Chalom on Shabbos? Because when a person has a bad dream that they're worried about things, they have a tremendous amount of anxiety and fear, which they can only assuage by doing something like fasting. You feel better. So the Chassam Sofer says, not fasting might give you more pain and sadness than fasting. So you're allowed to fast to kind of reduce the anxiety and trepidation by feeling that you're doing something. So the Chassam Sofer says, you see from here that fasting is permitted on Shabbos if as a result of the fasting your anxiety gets reduced. Says the Chassam Sofer, unlike Tisha B'Av, which is fasting over tragedies of the past, Asara B'Teves is like a bad dream. Why is that so? Because he brings from a number of sources. Every Asara B'Teves, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides whether the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt before Tisha B'Av. In other words, in effect, this is the Yom HaDin of Tisha B'Av this coming year. Asara B'Teves, Hashem may paskin that Tisha B'Av Mashiach will be born and will come. Or Chas V'Shalom, Hashem may paskin that the Beis HaMikdash will remain in a state of Chorban. So the Chassam Sofer says, we fast on Asara B'Teves, not simply to remember the tragedies of the past, but to try to be Mevakesh Hashem, that the din on Asara B'Teves shouldn't be to continue the Chorban. And therefore the Chassam Sofer says, this is why you could fast even on Shabbos, because it is similar to a Tanis Chalom, where you're fasting to be mevatel the prospective gezeira ra'a, takes away your anxiety. This is Asara B'Teves. So although halachically, this is what you call a less severe fast, if one is not well, you know, you're allowed to eat and drink much more liberally than would be the case for Tisha B'Av and certainly Yom Kippur. But it's a fast of great, great, extreme importance. Because if all of us are praying and hoping for the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, the Chassam Sofer says, this is the Yom HaDin in which Hashem decides. Now, the truth of the matter is, just like you can do tshuva the whole year, so even after this din, we do tshuva, of course. But still, this is when things are actually in the balance. And it's much easier, so to speak, to be mevakesh rachamim before there's that din than after there's that din. So that's something that Chassam Sofer teaches us about Asara B'Teves. There is another tradition about Asara B'Teves that's a little less known, and I actually did not find a makor in Chazal, so I don't know where the Svarim get it. But a number of Svarim say Asara B'Teves was the date of Mechiras Yosef. That there was a tradition that Yosef was sold by his brothers on Asara B'Teves. And the same way, for example, that the breaking of the Chet HaEgel, the breaking of the Luchos, is what made the 17th of Tammuz a tragic day. And the same way that the sin of the Meraglim, when they came back and gave a report and people cried and didn't have faith on the 9th of Av, that made the 9th of Av a tragic day. So the Sheirish of Asara B'Teves, being a day of Paranios, in a day of tragedy, emanates in the Sinas Chinam, the hatred that the brothers exhibited for Yosef, and this is why Asar B'Teves is always comes during the Parshios of Mechiras Yosef, because indeed Mechiras Yosef happened in Asar B'Teves. Now again, I would be very interested in seeing what the first makar of this is. I did not find it in a medrash, but the Svarim HaKadoshim, the Svarim do bring such a edition of Mechiras Yosef being in Asar B'Teves. In addition, if you looked at Slichos this morning, or you may know it from history generally, in fact, Asar B'Teves is the third day of what should have been a three-day fast. There should have been a fast on the 8th, on the 9th, and on the 10th, although Chazal didn't want to make it so difficult, so they only have one day fast. And that is, there are three different tragedies which are historically not related. They did not occur at the same time. On the 9th, going immediately backwards, was the death of Ezra HaSofer. Now Ezra HaSofer was the leader of the Jewish people who came up when the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt after the 70 years of exile. And Ezra was extraordinarily great. The Gemara basically says, had Moshe Rabbeinu not received the Torah, Ezra would have been great enough to receive the Torah for Klal Yisrael. We don't fully appreciate what Ezra did. After the Jewish people lost the Beis HaMikdash and they thought their relationship with Hashem was over, he was able to bring back emunah in Torah and mitzvos. He created the body that is known as the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who actually wrote the Siddur. They wrote the Tfilos and they enacted many, many takanas for Klal Yisrael. And as a result, Chazal said that the death of Ezra HaSofer, which such a great, great person who was like a Moshe Rabbeinu substitute, was deserving of a fast day, and that was on the 9th of Teves. And we think about Ezra HaSofer this day as well, the one who brought Torah back to Am Yisrael. And the 8th day is something that's also later than that, right? So actually in reverse order. The earliest tragedy was the 10th of Teves, Nebuchadnezzar's siege. The next tragedy is like 70 years later, and that is the death of Ezra, right? You know, 80 years later, 80 or 85 years later, because Ezra did survive the building of the Second Temple. The third tragedy is around 100 years after that, even before the Hanukkah story. And this was the completion of the Torah into Greek. Very interesting that we would consider this to be so tragic, and that is, at a time when Eretz Yisrael was under Greek rule, this is before Antiochus, this is under the Ptolemaic kings of Egypt. So Ptolemy II, technically, was a book collector. In fact, his library in Alexandria was one of the wonders of the world. It was like the Library of Congress. It had all of the books that were known in the ancient world. And he wanted to commission a translation of the Torah into Greek. And as a result, because Greek was the spoken language of the empire, and he commissioned 70 elders to translate the Torah into Greek, and they were put into separate rooms. He wanted to see if they would come up with the same translation. And miraculously, through Ruach HaKodesh, they came up with the same translations, and the Gemara gives us a listing of things, of changes that they made. For example, Bereshit Bara Elokim, which we translate in the beginning God created, but if you took it very literally, it could mean the beginning created God, which would have been misleading, so they switched the word order. In a more minor way, when the Torah lists non-kosher animals, it lists the Arneves, the rabbit, and apparently Mrs. Ptolemy's name in Greek was whatever the Greek name for rabbit was. So if they would have written in Greek, the rabbit is impure and no good, it would have been an insult, so they changed it to some synonym. In other words, they thought of all of these different things. And this is known as the Targum HaShivim, the translation of the 70 elders. And the official name, which is again in Latin, is the Septuagint, which is the translation of the 70, that's all it means. And it's still available. If you can read Greek, you can actually see the Greek If you read an English translation, it wouldn't sound much different than any English translation, although there are some interesting halachic differences. The Septuagint was actually much, much more makubal among Christians than among Jews. Jews did not consider the Septuagint as part of the Masorah, because it sometimes deviates from Torah Shebal Peh. But nevertheless, Chazal say, on the day that the Septuagint was completed, which was the 8th of Teves, 3 days of darkness came upon the world. Chazal considered it to be a tragic event. Now, just to give you an example how different perspectives were different, Philo of Alexandria was a traditional Jew, and he was the most prominent learned Jew in the Alexandrian Hellenist community. And Philo records that in Alexandria, they would actually make a Yom Tov celebrating the day the Septuagint was completed. That was a big simcha, because that's how they learned Torah. So what Chazal in Eretz Yisrael regarded as a tragedy, the Jews of Alexandria regarded as a simcha. They would go out to the parks and have a meal and everything else. So we have our three tragedies. We have 10th of Teves, Melech Bavel begins his siege against Jerusalem. 9th of Teves, the death of Ezra HaSofer. Going backwards, 8th of Teves, the completion of the Targum, Hashivim. What was so tragic about the completion of the Torah into Greek, after all? Isn't it a great thing when the Torah becomes understandable by those who don't know Hebrew? And there are many different explanations that you can give. One is that even if something is necessary, it may be a cause for sadness. I remember when the Art Scroll came out, right? So people actually brought up the idea. Well, what are you so happy about? You know, isn't that the idea? But part of the idea is that even when translations are a good thing and a necessary thing, we can be very sad that they are necessary. That people didn't know Lashon HaKodesh, people couldn't read the Torah in its original language, especially since even the best translation can only capture part of the richness of meaning. It's not at all possible. So one way of looking at it is, it was actually a good thing, but we were saddened that it became necessary. Other interpretations was it was a bad thing, because by translating the Torah into foreign languages, you are giving non-Jews input in how those verses will be interpreted. The same way where we wanted the oral law not to be written down to prevent contamination. Right now, all the goyim could look at the Torah and they could interpret this way and that way and that way and that way, and there could be distortions that are introduced. Be it as it may, the Slichos tell us that on Asara B'Teves, we are not only thinking about the particular tragedy of Asarah B'Teves, but we're also thinking about the 8th and the 9th as well. These are the 3 days of Tzoros that we're thinking about. But having said that, I do want to focus particularly on the 10th of Teves, on the beginning of the siege of Melech Bavel. The point of mourning the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Why do we mourn the Churban Beis HaMikdash? What? We were exiled from the land. We're back in the land. Yerushalayim was desolated. Baruch Hashem, Yerushalayim is built. What is it that we commemorate? What is it that we're saddened about? Whether it's the 10th of Teves, whether it's even Tisha B'Av. You know, there's a movement within religious Jewry. On Tisha B'Av, we recite a prayer, God should give comfort to the city that is abandoned, to the city that is burnt. There is movement within particularly the Atili Yomi community to abrogate that blessing, which halachically we would not accept, but still, we have Yerushalayim. It's Bazuya, right? It's Benuya. So what is it that we mourn? And in truth, we're not mourning the lack of a building. And we're not mourning the lack of political independence. We are mourning the exile of the divine presence from our hearts and from our soul, of which the Beis HaMikdash was simply a tangible, physical representation. of the Shekhinah that dwells in our soul. Go back to the first verse when Hashem commanded us to build a Mishkan, which is the Beis HaMikdash. V'yasu li Mikdash, make for me a Mikdash. V'shachanti b'socham, so I will dwell in them. The Medrash tells us the Shekhinah doesn't dwell in the Beis HaMikdash. The Shekhinah dwells in the heart and the soul of every Jew who serves Hashem. So how could the Beis HaMikdash be destroyed? The Beis HaMikdash was not destroyed by the Babylonians, and it was not destroyed by the Romans. When God's presence was no longer in our hearts and in our soul, the Beis HaMikdash was just a building. And when it was just a building, anybody could destroy it. The Gemara tells us that Nebuchadnezzar, when he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, was very proud. Nebuchadnezzar said, I destroyed the house of God. And God told him, essentially, I don't live there anymore. You didn't destroy my house. You destroyed a house that was vacant. You destroyed a house in which the Shekhinah was no longer there. Because when you don't have the Shachanti B'Socham, you don't have a Beis HaMikdash. You have a house. A house anybody could destroy. And in fact, throughout the book of Yirmiyahu, you see that the Jewish people, through their false prophets, had a false and inflated sense of security because they thought they had the Beis HaMikdash like a magical charm, a talisman. We have the house of God, and therefore God is with us. And therefore we cannot fail because God is with us. We have korbanos. Although we worship idols to cover our bets. But, you know, we're giving God his bribes. We have a temple. And you find this as a constant refrain. As long as we have the temple, we cannot fall. But the mistake in that thinking is, the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, is a symbol. It's not that the Beis HaMikdash protects you. The Beis HaMikdash is a reflection of what you are. When you're not that person, the Beis HaMikdash is just a building. The Shekhinah is no longer there. So, if you really want to know the truth, the Beis HaMikdash was not destroyed on the 9th of Av, and it was not the siege against Yerushalayim that resulted in the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Rather, at some unknown date, and I can't give you the date, when you no longer had a critical mass of Am Yisrael, where the Shekhinah was in their heart and in their soul, Hashem was no longer in the bias. And that is why the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah describes in very painful ways how the Shekhinah left the Beis HaMikdash in 10 levels. It first left the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and it waited, and it was yearning for us to do tshuva. And then it moved into the courtyard. And the Gemara describes 10 different places. Each one, it stopped and waited. The Navi Yecheskel describes it. And the last stop happened to be the Mount of Olives, where the Shekhinah Kavyochel has one last gaze at his city and at his people. Hoping we would turn back. Didn't happen. Went back to Shemayim or whatever process was involved. So this explains a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi tells us in every generation that the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt is as guilty as the generation in which the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. What is the Yerushalmi telling us? Without the Yerushalmi, we might have thought the following. The temple was destroyed because those people had real bad averus. We're not so bad, but we don't have the extra zechus to get the Beis HaMikdash back. The Yerushalmi says, not true. You don't need extra zechus to get the Beis HaMikdash back. Rather, if Chazal say the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of X, Y, and Z, then by definition, we still have the X, Y, and Z. In other words, we are destroying the Beis HaMikdash every single day. Every single day it is not rebuilt. We are reburning it. We are redestroying it. We are preventing it. Because when the Shekhinah is not in us, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. Chorban is not an event of which we still suffer the consequences. Chorban is a daily, hourly, minute-by-minute occurrence. Called, again, the Yerushalmi, Kol Dor Shelo Nivna B'Yamav, any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is not Nivna, Ki'ilu Nechrav B'Yamav, it is as if it is being destroyed. So consequently, if indeed the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because the Shekhinah was banished from our heart and our soul, and if indeed the very reasons why we did not have the Shekhinah are the reasons that still apply today, we have to think about what can I do in my life to rebuild this Beis HaMikdash? What can I do to make my heart and my soul a repository for Hashem? Bilvavi Mishkan Evnech, in my heart I have to build a Mishkan for Hashem. So here is where I think we run into a little bit of a problem with Asara B'Teves in particular. Everybody knows the famous Gemara in Maseches Yuma that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of the worst Averos. Avodah Zarah, idolatry, Giloy Arayos, sexual immorality, Shvichas Damim, murder. Call them the big three. Those are the three Averos that a Jew has to give up his life before he transgresses. The time of the second Beis HaMikdash, Chazal tell us the Jews were righteous, the Jews were tzaddikim, they were Shomer Mitzvahs. Why was the second Beis HaMikdash destroyed? So the Gemara says, because of sinas chinam, hatred, polarization, machlokes in Am Yisrael. By the way, there's a famous Hakdama of the Nitziv of Volozhin in the 19th century, explained that the sinas chinam that caused the Chorban Bayis Sheni was that the Jewish people were divided into many different sects and groups with different hashkafos and different beliefs, and they were looking down at each other, calling each other apikores, min, sedukim. And the Nitziv says, this idea of the famous idea that anyone to the right of me is a fanatic, and anyone to the left of me is an apikores. It is only I, whoever the I is, who is positioned in the correct way. The Nitziv says that this notion of looking down at Jews who were different was the sinas chinam that was goring the Chorban of the Bayis Sheni. Now the Nitziv was criticized, by the way. In a way, the criticism almost confirmed that he was correct, because basically he was attacked for being heretical in his tolerance towards those who deviated. It's kind of similar, Lahavdil, when the Pope made a statement that Muslims were inclined to violence. So there were violent protests against his insults. Right? That proves that he's wrong, right? Okay, I mean, obviously. But the point is, that's the sinas chinam of the Bayis Sheni. So here's the problem I want to share with you. My problem is the following. If we were to think about the Chorban Beis HaMikdash in terms of the Chorban Bayis Sheni, and we would then examine our heart and our soul for sinas chinam, very unfortunately, we know that we are all still suffering from this. We are suffering from polarization, lack of achdus, lack of avas Yisrael, looking down at people, only being comfortable within our own group and not acknowledging the legitimacy and the beauty of others, even if they have different approaches in Avodas Hashem. And Be'avonoseinu HaRabim, Sinas Chinam, is a machala a cancer, a sickness that is very much within us. And we'd have no problem, I think, in recognizing. Maybe we have a problem in doing something about it, but l'chol hapachas, we would have no problem in recognizing that sinas chinam is, unfortunately, alive and well. And I want to point out, too, that sinas chinam is not only what you might call hot hatred, like throwing rocks or whatever it is, but sinas chinam includes coldness, indifference, not caring, not being concerned for what happens to other Jews. That's also a form of sinas chinam. And what makes sinas chinam so pernicious is that nobody ever says it's chinam. In other words, sure, I'm against not liking people for no reason at all. I have my reasons. Apparently, Chazal said, even if you have a reason, it's not a good reason. But here is my kasha. Asara b'teves is not about the bias sheni. Asara b'teves is about the bias rishon. The bias rishon was necharav because of the three big averos, avodah zarah, gilui arayos, shvichas damim. So would it not stand to reason that what we think about today is not sinas chinam, but we think about avodah zarah, gilui arayos, shvichas damim? And that could stymie us a little bit, because, well, it's one thing to say I'm guilty of sinas chinam, but avodah zarah, gilui arayos, shvichas damim, I'm not that bad. In other words, what shaychus do we have? What connection, right? The connection to sinas chinam, bavanaseinu rabim, we do have. And that's something that each of us can think about and identify with and look around and see that this is the condition of our world. But avodah zarah, gilui shlichus damim, and we're not that bad. We don't do that stuff. So one answer might be that even on asara b'teves, sinas chinam is something we think about. I had mentioned in the beginning of my remarks, it was the day of Mechiras Yosef, right? So there is that connection. But what I want to share with you is a few thoughts about how even Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim have messages that are relevant to us on the day of Chorban. And I'll mention a few overlapping approaches. Approach number one is that even if I'm not guilty of these sins in a very literal way, Chazal identify many other averos as equivalent to the big three. For example, Lashon Hara is described as a form of murder because you destroy somebody's character, somebody's standing in the community. Chazal say anger is like avodah zarah, like idol worship. And the Bala Tanya offers a very beautiful explanation. Because if you truly believe Hashem runs the world, like the Chavos HaLevavos says, right, going back to Shara Bitachon, the Chavos HaLevavos says, nobody in the world can hurt you or help you unless Hashem decreed that that's so. So even though Hashem doesn't make a person make a choice, in other words, the person who hurts me, that's his bechira, but in terms of my receiving the hurt, it's only Hashem's gezeira. So if you truly believed it all comes from God, what are you angry about? It's from Hashem. Elamai, you don't believe it comes from God. You believe it comes from Him. That's avodah zarah. That's what Bala Tanya says. Kol HaKohen, right? So, Lashon Hara is like murder. Anger is like avodah zarah. Chazal say when you humiliate somebody publicly, that's a form of murder. So yes, maybe I didn't murder somebody by sticking a knife into his heart. But Lashon Hara, embarrassing. Maybe I didn't bow down to an idol. But was I angry because I didn't accept that Hashem was running the world? That's avodah zarah. Gilui arayos? Well, once again, although Gilui arayos in a literal sense may refer to intercourse with a forbidden erva, and you know, people didn't do that. But we certainly live in a world of all sorts of sexual stimuli that are improper. And a person might have linked into some of that on some level. There's a Gili Arayas. I would add further, too, about Gili Arayas, a thought to think about, although this is a bit of a stretch. And that is, if you think about Gili Arayas, like the worst Gili Arayas is adultery, Eishes Ish. Right? That's the only one of the Arayas that is explicitly prohibited in the Aseres Hadibros, Lotinov. And if you think about why is adultery so bad, adultery is so bad besides the fact that it's a sin ben adam lamakom, adultery is a betrayal of the trust that one spouse puts into another spouse. In marriage, there needs to be trust that you can depend on the other person, that the other person is connected to you. When they go and they break that trust, that's a betrayal of a relationship. Seen in that way, in that symbolic way, adultery can exist whenever there is the betrayal of the relationship of husband and wife, even if it's through just neglect, indifference, coldness, workaholism. People are sometimes married to their work, and the like. So on that level, Gili Arayos might exist in terms of the emotional coldness and distancing between husband and wife. So answer number one, how do I make relevant the categories of Avodah Zarah, Gili Arayos, Shvichas Damim, which I have to because I'm connecting this day to the Chorban Bayis Rishain and not the Chorban Bayis Sheni? Answer, by recognizing that the sins of Avodah Zarah, Gili Arayos, Shvichas Damim are not always taken literally, but they have analogs to other spiritual failings. Kas is Avodah Zarah. Lashon Hara is Ritzicha. Malbin Pnei Chavero, embarrassing somebody, is considered to be murder. Emotional distancing between spouses is a form of adultery. Gili Arayos. And of course, exposure to all of the lack of tznius that exists in the world is also connected to Gili Arayos, right? So that is approach number one, how we can still look at Avodah Zarah, Gili Arayos, as relevant categories to us. Approach number two, you know, anti-Semites like to say, they like to blame Jews for all the world's evils. Well, the little secret is, and don't tell anybody, outside the room, is that the Torah actually agrees with much of the anti-Semites say. In fact, the Jews are responsible for all the world's evils, in the sense that the Chafetz Chaim once remarked that the intensity of the learning in the little shtetl of Radin would influence the tznius of the fashions in Paris, 2,000 miles away. How does that work? Just like an atom bomb, l'havdil, you have ground zero where the radiation is most intense and most powerful. And as you go further and further out, there is still radiation, but it's less intense. And that goes for thousands and thousands of miles. So too in Ruchnius and Kedusha, the goodness that we do, the Torah that we learn, the chesed and avas Yisrael that we show, creates waves of holiness and goodness that can affect the world in all sorts of ways. The world will be a better world if we are better people. The Chafetz Chaim's point is that the learning in Radin is not going to make people in Paris learn. That's too much. But l'chol apachas, it may affect, you know, a fashion in one detail or another. So too, the holiness that we can generate by our mitzvahs, even if we're not openly teaching about it. In other words, it's not, you know, it's not that you stand on a soapbox and make speeches. The everyday, day-to-day way we live our lives creates waves of kedusha in the world that the world can be a different world because of what we do. We have the koach to bring God's light into the world in many, many ways. You know, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, was, in addition, of course, to being the Gadol Hador in Halacha, was actually a great Mekubal. It's actually very fascinating that in the Shulchan Aruch, he brings in very little Kabbalah. He kept his two careers separate. But in fact, he was a great, great Mekubal. It's interesting, he was much older. He was the Rav of Tzfat. He was in his 70s when the Arizal came to Tzfat. The Arizal died at 38. The Ari came to Tzfat at 36 and died 2 years later. Rav Yosef Karo, in his humility, went to learn when the Ari would give a shir, but he always fell asleep. And the Arizal, which, you know, Rav Yosef Karo wouldn't normally fall asleep, the Arizal said it was nigzer min shemayim that I should not be your Rebbe, that you're great enough, you shouldn't learn from me. So Hashem makes you fall asleep every time I teach, the Arizal told him. It's a nice way of comforting somebody to fall asleep during the shiur, but in that case, we assume that it's true. But Rav Yosef Karo actually had an angel that was his chavrusa. An angel, we called his magid, his preacher. And he actually wrote the Torah that he learned with the angel. You can actually get the Sefer. The Sefer is called Magid Mesharim, which is a diary of his discussions with his private malach that he would learn with. And in the Magid Mesharim, Rav Yosef Karo tells the following story. And if you've been to Tzfat, you can imagine the narrow alleyways of Tzfat. Rav Yosef Karo's shul is in Tzfat and the like. And the story goes that he was once learning a very difficult sugya in Gemara, and he spent weeks on it to try to understand it, and he finally understood exactly what it was saying. And he had a tremendous simcha that Hashem rewarded his toil with such a good understanding. He's walking in the narrow alleyways of the old Tzfat, and he overhears a shoemaker learning Gemara with his 7-year-old son. And it was the same Gemara of Karo was just looking at, and, you know, didn't want to eavesdrop, but was a little curious. The child asks his father the very question that bothered Rav Yosef Karo. The child. And the father was annoyed with the child, 7-year-old. The father said, you know, you're asking such foolish questions. You know, even a child your age should understand this. And the father proceeded to give the same answer that Rav Yosef Karo had spent several weeks trying to figure out. So Rav Yosef Karo was devastated because not only did this person have the answer right away, but the person considered the answer to be so elementary that if his 7-year-old didn't get it, the 7-year-old wasn't paying attention. So it was obvious, it was simple. And Rav Karo didn't understand. Why didn't I understand this? Why didn't I get this? Was God punishing me? Was God saying I wasn't worthy to understand a simple aspect of Torah? So he had someone to ask. He asked his angel, what's the story here? What is my aveira for which I must do tshuva? So he writes, this was a private diary, not intended for publication, by the way. He was not writing it to be published. He writes that the malach told me, it's exactly the opposite. This insight was deep and profound, and the world was not worthy of it. But through your work, you brought it into the world. Once you brought it into the world, anybody can get it. Now, on a rational level, that makes no sense at all. He didn't teach it to anybody. He didn't say it to anybody. He didn't write it down to anybody. This was a totally private action that was just in his brain. So what do you mean, once he brings it into the world, other people can get it? The answer is, that is the nature of Kedusha. The silent, private, unknown goodness that we do in our lives changes the world in different ways. Yes, we have an achrayus to also teach and be makariv. We don't proselytize per se, but we have an, you know, we try to show others a good way of living. But the bottom line is, even what you do totally privately adds something to the Kedusha of the world, and people are changed in different ways. That is why we say when a gadol dies, you know, a gadol dies, there's a void. I mean, what do you mean the gadol? I mean, you know, most of us never even spoke to the gadol. Maybe we never saw the gadol. The answer is when there's holiness in the world, our lives are changed also in ways we didn't even know. So how is this connected to Avodah Zarah, Gira, Shvichas Damim? In the following way. Yes, perhaps I'm not guilty in any literal sense of Avodah Zarah, Gila Raya, Shvichas Damim. Yes. But I certainly live in a world that has plenty of that. I live in a world that is filled with murder and violence. Right, and we've experienced this, and the most recent one is, you know, the massacre in Connecticut of first grade children, including one Jewish child, at least one Jewish child that I know of. And here in Eretz Yisrael, unfortunately, we have had our share of tragedies, murders, violence. We live in a world of Gilui Arayos, is quite obvious, where all the boundaries of restraint that civilized people normally have broken down. And we live in a world of Avodah Zarah, to a small degree, literally, if you talk about Buddhism and the like. In a larger degree, if Avodah Zarah is understood as anything that sets up a priority other than serving God, whether it's money or politics or power. So we live in a world that is filled with Avodah Zarah, Gila Raya, Shvichas Damim, and we have to understand that we bear a certain responsibility for that. Because the more Kedusha we could generate in our lives, the less Tumah there would be in the world. It's no defense to say, so to speak, I didn't do the Tumah. Because indeed, like the anti-Semites say, Jews are blamed for everything. And that is, we do have a kayach to change the world, not by forcing people to be a certain way, but by being a certain way ourselves. The world can be transformed. And therefore, we are all complicit in the Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim that exists in the world. So that would be explanation number two. So explanation number one is linking the Averis to anger, etc. Explanation number two is the notion of our responsibility for the world, like Rav Yosef Karo's story. Explanation number three, which overlaps a little bit, is a thought of Rav Tzadok of Lublin, who says the following insights. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Raya, Shvichas Damim are, of course, Averos, and very serious Averos. But spiritually, they are symptoms of character flaws. And just as is the case with human illness, a person may have an illness without the symptoms, right? That's asymptomatic. That's actually a very not good place to be, because a person has the machla and has no way of knowing that they have it. But so too, Rav Tzadok says, one can have the illness of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, even without the symptomology. What is the illness? What is the root? So he says, the root of these awful Averos are what Pirkei Avos says, Hakina v'hataiva v'hakavot. Kina is jealousy. Taiva is excessive hedonistic lust. I say excessive because Judaism is not ascetic per se, but excessive hedonistic lust for the pleasures of the world, and kavod is the incessant desire for honor and ego gratification. These are the big three of midos, negative midos. Kina, taiva, kavod. What does Pirkei Avos say about this? Motzien es ha'adam min ha'olam, they take a person out of the world. The altar of Slobodka used to say, it doesn't only mean you lose your world to come, but even this world is lousy. Meaning, you can see this. If a person is filled with jealousy, they will never enjoy the blessings Hashem has given them. Taiva, you always need more. And kavod, that's the worst of all. Kavod, you never get enough kavod. When you want kavod, you never get enough kavod. You know, somebody says, whatever it is, somebody said, I really liked your shiur today, so the Baal Kavod will think, you didn't like it last week? You know, you look nice today. Whatever it is, with kavod, there's no way that a Baal Kavod can get all the kavod that they want. It's not shaykh. Even by Yeravim ben Nevat, the Gemara says, Hashem came to Yeravim ben Nevat, you know, the first king of the 10 tribes, and says, Yeravim, if you do tshuva, you, I, and David HaMelech will walk together in Gan Eden. And Yeravim ben Nevat says, who's going to be first? And when Hashem said David, he says, I don't want the deal. Actually, the Kutzker says, when he says, who's going to be first? He meant, is Hashem going to be first even? Even that he wouldn't have been happy with. I cover. So this is what Rav Tzadok says. Rav Tzadok says, jealousy, when taken to an extreme, leads to shvichas damim. And indeed, statistically, that's true. Putting aside serial murderers that are a different category, the average one-to-one murder is normally a result of jealousy. Even this massacre in Connecticut, bizarrely enough, I mean, the murderer was not mentally balanced, but he felt his mother cared more about the first graders than about him. So the actual motive was a sense of jealousy that he felt, you know. She loves them and she doesn't love me. Jealousy. So jealousy can make a person mad, crazy, that he kills. Taiva, lust for sensuality, can of course culminate in Gilui Arayos. I'm too attached to physical pleasure. Now, kavod and avodah zarah, this is already a little more difficult. The association is a bit more subtle. But Rav Tzadok says that the psychological impetus within a human being to seek idolatry is to create God in the image of man instead of man in the image of God. Think about the Greek gods, small g. Right? If you remember, in the olden days when I was growing up, we still did Greek mythology. I think today the religious schools don't do it anymore. But if you're familiar in some way with the Greek idols, they were nothing more than dysfunctional human beings with superpowers. They were selfish, or even worse than most people were. They got into marital fights. They stole. They were dishonest. They cheated. They happened to have superpowers. So Rav Tzadok says, Avodah Zarah in that way is the ultimate arrogance of creating divinity that is nothing more than you, augmented with all sorts of powers. Instead of man being in the image of God in terms of Bechira, you make God in the image of man. Moreover, Avodah Zarah is creating a system of religion that allows you to do whatever you want. It's like the old story about the archer who always, all of their arrows were in the bullseye. And when they were asked, how do you always get a bullseye? He says, very easy. I shoot the arrow where I want it to go, then I draw the target. You have to understand, Avodah Zarah made no demand. Well, I mean, basically, Avodah Zarah looked at God like a mafia protection racket. The concept basically is, you do what you want, but give your sacrifices. But you give a sacrifice, pay off God or pay off the idol. You can lie, you can cheat, you can commit adultery, you can murder, because after all, they do that too. The God does that as well. So Rav Tzadok says, Avodah Zarah is ultimately about self-worship. You're worshiping yourself. And that's connected to kavod. So Rav Tzadok's insight is, maybe I'm not guilty with Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, but the roots of those averos, the root of those symptoms, is indeed kina, taiva, kavod. Again, sicknesses that we all have to grapple with. We all hope to improve ourselves in these areas. But certainly, these are things that we have to face in our life, that we have to work with. So, Bekitzer, I'm trying to bring out the idea that although Asara B'Teves does not have a direct connection to the Chorban Bayis Sheni, Asara B'Teves is connected with the Chorban Bayis Rishon, and the Averis of the Chorban Bayis Rishon seem to be beyond our connection, Avodah Zorah, Gilei Raya, Shvichus Damim. In fact, in various ways, we link to that as well. And we think about how we can build the Beis HaMikdash in our hearts and our souls. One other point, though. The Gemara Nedarim tells us... One other point, though, is the Gemara Nedarim gives us one other sin of the first Beis HaMikdash, not the second. The Navi says, we read this on Tisha B'Av, the Navi Yirmiyahu says, Alma of the Haaretz. Remember, he was the prophet who experienced the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Why is the land destroyed? And the answer is, Al Azvam Es Torasi, because they have forsaken my Torah. Now the Gemara in Nedarim explains, they asked all the prophets, why was the land destroyed? Nobody knew. And Hashem had to tell them. But the kasha is, if the answer is they're not keeping the Torah, why wouldn't the prophets know? So the Gemara says, when it says they're not keeping the Torah, it doesn't mean they weren't keeping the Torah, but it means they weren't reciting blessings over the Torah. They were learning, but they weren't reciting blessings over the Torah. The Chorban Beis HaMikdash came because they weren't reciting blessings over the Torah. Now that's talking about the first Beis HaMikdash. So the whole Gemara is a big problem. First of all, good, you're supposed to recite blessings over the Torah. That's a halacha. But if you don't do it, it's not that serious an Aveira. Second of all, if the Jews were doing Avodah Zorah, Gilei Raya, Shvichus Damim, why do we have to come up with a lesser sin? Right? The Nevi'im didn't know? I mean, what do the Nevi'im say? They say over and over again, because of your Averos, the land is going to be destroyed. The Nevi'im didn't know, and they have to ask Hashem. What's going on? So let me share with you a pshat from Avelia Lapyan, one of the great, great Balei Musar. The last of the, well, not the last, but almost among the last of the great Balei Musar who died around 15 years ago. Just a short example of the type of Musar that Avelia represented. It's kind of almost an extinct breed today. He was in his 90s, and he was waiting for a bus, and he was learning Mishnayos, or saying Tehillim. And the bus, I'm sure all of us have experienced this more than once, the bus was 25 minutes late. And after around 20 minutes, he looked up momentarily from the Mishnayos to see if the bus was coming. And then he started sobbing and crying, he says. Because in Kelim, where he had learned, you don't stop, you know, you don't look up. What is it like? The bus will come when it comes. What are you looking up? Impatient. You're doing Avodas Hashem. And he says, I'm 90 years old and look what I've become. He says, I've become a mushchas. That's just kind of the old Baal Musar that very, very few exist today. But Develia Lapyan offers the following explanation. Do you remember the book of Malachim? The book of Malachim begins with David HaMelech ill. And he's cold. He's very cold. And even when he's covered with blankets and garments, they do not give him warmth. And what do Chazal say? Chazal say, he who is mevazeh begadim, if you treat clothing with disrespect, the clothing has revenge and will not give you warmth. And because David had cut off a corner of Shaul's garments, which was disrespectful, not to Shaul, but to the clothing, the clothing does not give him warmth. Right? So if your kids or your husbands throw around clothing, you can tell them this this message. Now, what do you see from that Gemara? You see from that Gemara that that which you are mevazeh, that which you treat with disrespect, doesn't give you protection. So here's what Revelia says. When the Nevi'im were stymied, and the Nevi'im didn't understand why is there a Chorban, They weren't asking what sins caused the Chorban. They knew very well what sins caused the Chorban. The Chorban was caused because of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayas, Shevichas Tamim. They knew that. But what they were asking is the following. But given the fact that the Jewish people were learning Torah, which they were, why shouldn't the Torah protect them from their sins? In other words, they didn't understand. They had cognitive dissonance. They didn't understand. How is it shayach? A person is learning Torah, morning seder in yeshiva, and during lunch he goes out and rapes, murders, and pillages. Then comes back in time for mincha, does daf yomi, and then does a few more murders before night seder. Doesn't Torah change a person? Doesn't my learning have some impact on the Nevi'im? The Nevi'im knew the Avera of the Chorban was Avodah Zarah, but why didn't the Torah change them? The answer is, just like clothing, you don't have respect for what clothing does. It doesn't do its job. If you don't have respect and love for the Torah, the physical, mechanical aspect of engaging in Torah is not going to change it. And not making the blessing over the Torah means they didn't consider the Torah to be something precious. They didn't consider it to be something good and wonderful. They did it because they did it, intellectual stimulation, sense of duty. And memela, that's right. So it's not that the Chorban came as a punishment for not blessing the Torah. The Chorban came as a punishment for Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shevichas Damim. But if they would have had a different attitude towards Yiddishkeit, towards Torah, they would have been protected from all of those Averis. Now, this itself, since this is the Chorban Bayis Rishon, this is still an appropriate meditation today, because what it tells us is the following. It tells us that closeness to God is not an automatic consequence of doing Torah and doing mitzvahs. But the attitude, the enthusiasm, the joy, and the love, and the appreciation that we have for what Hashem gives us will determine how much the mitzvahs will elevate us. The same way you treat a piece of clothing with disdain, it's not going to give you warmth. When we look at the Torah as something burdensome, it's not going to give us spiritual protection either. And therefore, part of the avodah is to not only intensify our commitment in how we in the mitzvahs that we do and how we keep the mitzvahs, but to also understand the joy. This is a very important thing. This is something we all go through. You know, sometimes being a religious Jew does involve a lot of work. You're cleaning for Pesach, whatever it is. But we sometimes communicate attitudes, all of us, of it's kind of a drudgery, it's kind of a drag, I'd rather be doing something else. Children, of course, pick up on this. But we also have to know, too, that the elevating kayach of the mitzvahs is a function of our simcha and our joy in doing it. So Be'ezus Hashem, as I mentioned, the Chassam Sefer says, today is a very important Yom HaDin. It'll be Nigzer Min HaShemayim, whether the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt before Tisha B'Av or not. May all of us be zeicha to a good din, and may the Gemar Din be that we should be zeichet to a binyan beis hamikdash b'mehirah v'yameinu. May our hearts and our souls be a makom for the Shechina of HaKadosh Baruch Hu.